My name is Ivy Boyd, and this is Spiritus, a paranormal history podcast. First, a quick note about this podcast's posting. There is no set schedule, I'm sorry, and episodes may not be released at the frequency which many other podcasts achieve. But this is for good reason. I strive to do my best in delivering good and accurate information as I explore this history and share it with you. And in order to do so, I take my time. As the philosopher Plato once said, "Better a little which is well done than a great deal imperfectly." Episode 1, Origins of the Ghost. A specter or apparition is an imagination of a substance without a body, the which presenteth itself sensibly unto men, against the order and course of nature, and maketh them afraid. This description comes to us from Pierre Laloyer in his Treatise on Spectres, 1605. And I love it. It's one of my favorite historical definitions to reference, but we must go a bit further back than the 1600s to learn more about the ghost, what it is, and where this belief in them came from. But first, some terminology. Ghost and spirit are usually synonymous. At least they are when talking about human ghosts and human spirits, as I will be discussing today. But there is sometimes a difference between the two. Ghost tends to be used for an earthbound spirit trapped here by some means. Meanwhile, spirit is used for those who have moved on to some kind of afterlife, but who can pass messages to the living or even return briefly for a bit of a haunting or to assist us. But for the sake of ease in discussing this topic, you will hear me use these terms interchangeably. And if I'm being honest, I've never really been a big stickler for this kind of terminology, so if you ask me, feel free to use whichever you like. Now let's talk about the long-awaited topic, the origins of the ghost. To do so, let's take a look at our ancestors, the Homo sapiens and Neanderthals. Yes, that's right, to try and understand the ghost, we have to go back to our earliest beginnings. For a timescale reference, the oldest known fossil records of Homo sapiens and Neanderthals date back to some 300,000 to 400,000 years ago. That's a long time for humans to evolve into who we are today. But in the grand timescale of a billions of years old Earth, human existence, simultaneously, isn't that long. So it's no wonder that some of the quarks of our most distant relatives might still be within us, including that funny little thing called anxiety. Some evolutionary anthropologists have hypothesized an evolutionary need to remain anxious of our environment. There would have been a clear advantage in assuming, for example, that if a twig snapped behind you, it might be a predatory animal, and in thinking this, you react accordingly. If it wasn't a predator, then the worst you suffered was a moment of panic which alleviates upon realizing you are safe. But by not reacting this way, if it was a predator, well, you might be dead. This habit of ours to assume something scary is hidden around us, this sense of an invisible, lurking evil, could translate not just into issues with the anxiety we still deal with, but it might be able to explain some of our jumpiness and the ghostly conclusions we tend to come to. When an object inexplicably falls off of a shelf, a lot of people react with a tinge of fear and worry of some kind of invisible presence behind it, a ghost. So could this be derived from a persisting fear of predatory animals? As someone who struggles with anxiety, I am kind of mad that my most ancient ancestors have passed this on to me. Assuming this hypothesis is correct, that is. If you'd like to read more about the evolutionary anxiety theory, Slate has an interesting article, which I will link below in the show notes, alongside my other sources. Oh, and a quick disclaimer regarding sources. I myself am a mishmash of beliefs and ideas. I even flip-flop on my own viewpoints from time to time upon discovering new information and alternative viewpoints, which I kind of think is how most people should be. One long talk with my skeptic husband, and even he has me questioning, wait, what if ghosts aren't real? But upon recalling some of my own paranormal encounters, I am reminded of why this all fascinates me in the first place, and that, yes, I do believe. Admittedly, as a believer, I can also have my own bias when covering the topic of ghosts because, well, I do love ghosts and believe in their existence. But bias is hard to avoid. Even the most credible of literary source material can be riddled with the bias of the brains behind it. And I believe that bias can be especially present when discussing something like ghosts, which we have no proof of. We cannot observe or study them, and people tend to very strongly believe in their existence, or they very vehemently deny it. To me, this is all the more reason to look further into this history of the beliefs themselves and consume all of the books and journals and blogs and viewpoints, and that does mean that sometimes I pull information from skeptics. We should ponder this often, and why not make a podcast about it? Let's get back to the topic. I don't believe the belief in ghosts or the perception of a ghost can be entirely blamed on evolutionary anxieties about hidden evils around us. And in studying Homo sapiens and Neanderthals, it also helps to examine the development of burying their dead and, more importantly, care shown for the dead. Because burying a body is just logically a smart thing to do, as our ancestors would have discovered, it helps to prevent the spread of disease and it hides the scent of the body from predators. But it may have also helped to soothe their grief, much like our burial methods do for us today through funerals and memorials. This comforting act of burying the dead is even seen in some animals, like elephants, who have been observed kicking dirt and debris onto their dead, who they also appear to mourn while revisiting the bones from time to time. This is debated, and they might be kicking dirt onto their dead again just to hide the smell from predators, but circling back to having bias, I kind of do choose to believe that they are taking part in their own elephant funerals. It's a nice thought, but back to humans. Intentionally burying the dead can also potentially signal the idea of having to care for someone in death because maybe they aren't actually gone. This is where the paranormal significance lays and why I feel it is pertinent when discussing the evolution of such beliefs. Caves have been discovered in regions such as Africa, Iraq, and France, with Homo sapien and Neanderthal burials from 60 to 70,000 years ago, give or take some 10,000 more years, and which appear to be deliberate, with some graves being carved down into stone, signaling that, yes, this individual was brought here and labor was done to create a grave and bury the body. And again, burying the body upon death for practical reasons is still on the table. But burying people deep in the ground and within the same caves over long periods of time, generation after generation after generation, feels meaningful, intentional, and almost ritual, doesn't it? Or maybe that is my inner whimsy that also wants to believe elephant funerals. Over time, burying the dead and the presence of grave goods or objects buried with the dead would grow significantly, offering today's archaeologists a better glimpse into humanity's past through the material objects buried with them. This was about 50,000 years ago-ish. And these objects being intentionally buried with the dead comes with the implication that we may have been starting to develop ideas and beliefs regarding what happens to us when we die. Do we live on somehow? Do we go somewhere? To some kind of afterlife? Common grave goods included tools which someone would have used during their life, perhaps in their established trade. And burying them with these objects could be done to honor them and say, these items are yours and they should stay with you in death. But this can also hint at early beliefs that the conscience of the formerly alive, their essence, their being, their soul, or what have you, carries on and that maybe they will need those same tools where they are going. But like I keep saying, we cannot know for sure. At least as far as these early examples go, which predate textual records. But it is quite possible. And the records would come, eventually. Ancient Mesopotamia, located in the region we now know as the Middle East, or more specifically, Iraq, is regarded as the first civilization due to its recognizable governing bodies and laws, and this is also where we got key inventions like the wheel and our earliest forms of record keeping via cuneiform writing. And it is through the latter that archaeologists, anthropologists, historians, linguists, and the like have uncovered and studied concrete evidence of the first known recorded belief in ghosts, which is ever present in these cuneiform tablets they left behind. And what we have learned is that in ancient Mesopotamia, ghosts weren't a belief in the sense that some people believed them and maybe some didn't. Rather, ghosts were just part of life, daily life. Dr. Irving Finkel talks about this in his book, The First Ghosts, and in his many online lectures, both of which I recommend and will be listed below in the show notes. Per the beliefs of the ancient Mesopotamians, which I did generalize to keep things simple, humans were created out of divine flesh and blood from the god Wa'ilu, also called Alia, mixed with clay and then animated with divine intelligence. The divine intelligence is what survives in death, most often called the Etemu, which has been translated to the spirit or ghost, and which, ideally, moves on to the afterlife, or the netherworld, post-death. But these ghosts were needy, because in death, they maintained certain needs and desires required of their once-living body. This includes food, drink, and even attention. No one wants to be hungry, thirsty, or ignored. Even me and my own reclusive, introverted, anxious nature, hence the podcasting, wouldn't want to be totally forgotten about. And you didn't want to be haunted, trust me. Hauntings were used by ancient people, in part, to elucidate the mysterious world around them and to explain, for example, illness and the spread of disease, among other misfortunes and even sudden death, which could all result from a haunting. This was, of course, long before we made advancements which allowed us to better understand these things and what can cause them. So, in the meantime, an earthbound ghost inflicting and harming the living made perfect sense. To help avoid a haunting, people of ancient Mesopotamia regularly gave offerings of food and drink and praise to the deceased, often burying their loved ones underneath their own homes for ease of tending to. This care shown to them, along with a proper burial, would help to ensure that their ghost could happily move on and stay that way. Neglect them, however, and now the ghost can become upset, angry even, and haunt you. In ancient Mesopotamia, external cemeteries would arise for those without people to care for them and who didn't have a home to be buried under, but the greatly neglected nature of those buried in cemeteries meant that the grounds were quite haunted with ghosts of the forgotten and should be avoided by the living. I should note that other miseries, not just neglect from the living, can lead to an earthbound ghost. This includes loneliness. Dr. Irving Finkel discovered a particularly intriguing paranormal artifact of sorts in the archives of the British Museum where he works. It is a fragment of a clay tablet about 2,300 years to 2,500 years old, and it details how to exorcise unwanted ghosts, and it includes the example of a man's ghost who was so distraught in his loneliness that he came back and haunted the living, and he was finally guided back to the afterlife via offerings and a female companion. This is even depicted in a carving on the backside of the tablet, and it remains possibly my favorite archaeological discovery because it is actually the first ever known depiction of a ghost. Dr. Finkel even earned a spot in the Guinness World Records for this discovery of the oldest depiction of a ghost. How cool is that? As much as I would love to keep talking about ancient Mesopotamian ghosts, I should move on. Roman ghosts were also often the result of the unrestful dead. Pliny the Younger, a 1st century CE Roman writer, lawyer, senator, and ponderer of ghosts, would write about ghost stories he had heard in a series of letters, which have been translated, and you can read them for yourself for free online on Project Gutenberg. I highly recommend it, and it's also linked below. Pliny the Younger begins one such letter by asking the recipient, and I quote, "I am extremely desirous, therefore, to know whether you believe in the existence of ghosts, and that they have a real form and are a sort of divinities, or only the visionary impressions of a terrified imagination." He goes on to share the story of a house so haunted that it struggled to maintain residents who were either frightened away or even died as a result of it. He continues, and I quote, "In the dead of the night, a noise, resembling the clashing of iron, was frequently heard, which, if you listened more attentively, sounded like the rattling of chains, distant at first, but approaching nearer by degrees. Immediately afterwards, a specter appeared in the form of an old man of extremely emaciated and squalid appearance, with a long beard and disheveled hair, rattling the chains on his feet and hands." Fun fact, this is the first known reference to a ghost rattling chains. A paranormal cliche we still see in a lot of ghostly media even today. Thankfully, this haunting was remedied when a philosopher, Athenodorus, bought the home and sought to fix the situation, letting the spirit guide him to a spot in the yard outside. Upon digging there, he found, and I quote, "the skeleton of a man in chains. The body, having lain a considerable time in the ground, was putrefied and moldered away from the fetters. The bones being collected together were publicly buried, and thus, after the ghost was appeased by the proper ceremonies, the house was haunted no more." To summarize this story, the ghost was upset over their improper burial and unmarked grave and was soothed upon receiving acknowledgement and a public burial. Sounds familiar, right? A similar belief in ghosts and clever ways to remedy the angry ones remained, or I should say remains, present in virtually every region on Earth and its societies and their cultures and religions. Take the yurei from Japanese folklore, for example. They are ghosts which result from usually violent or tragic deaths, and who did not receive proper burials, and who go on to haunt the living. You can pretty much take this blueprint and translate it to most regions of the earth. Treat people poorly in life, or not properly bury and honor them in death, and they might haunt you. And although ghosts have changed slightly over time as people and information travel, and to reflect people's current or local needs, and in keeping up with religious reforms and new earthly understandings, the ghost persists in one way or another, even when we try and remove them from our beliefs entirely. A great example which comes to mind is Christianity as it spread across Europe and became an authoritative powerhouse in the Middle Ages. The church would claim that ghosts weren't real because they didn't fit with their doctrine. That and the church wanted desperately to distance themselves from their pagan Roman predecessors and their ghosts. So, with the Bible as their guide, it was believed that God had full control of the soul, and, to put it simply, he either sends us to heaven or we face damnation. If earthbound ghosts existed, however, this meant that God wasn't in complete control of the soul. So, any ghostly happenings people encountered, according to the church, were actually the result of demons who were testing their faith in God by making them think that they were ghosts. But then the church would pull an Uno reverse and borrowed the concept of purgatory, first devised famously by Plato. That's the second Plato reference in this episode. Must mean something. An issue here, however, with the church accepting purgatory now is that purgatory wasn't in the Bible. So adding this to the church's teachings did ruffle some feathers, but it offered a chance at redemption where morals or the soul's sentencing were muddied. Let me explain. The idea here was that some souls could become trapped here via purgatory. Perhaps they sinned, which prevented them from entry into heaven, but it wasn't enough sin to be damned to hell. This gave some leeway. Purgatory acts as a sort of gray space or a last chance. People could then pray for forgiveness for the souls trapped in purgatory, Or they could ask the church for sermons for their dead, or even pay the church for sermons for the dead to free the souls of their loved ones who might be trapped in purgatory, and ideally, they could now enter heaven. This fear of having loved ones stuck in purgatory would become quite profitable for the church and was definitely exploited by them for some time. We can see, for the most part at least, that even as the ghost is threatened, new ideas can come about to explain their perceived presence around us. This can be seen again later on towards periods of enlightenment and industrial revolution. In learning more about the world and building upon the sciences and technology and gaining new understandings of life, waves of atheistic thinking would naturally come about. In the 1500s, the basic form for germ theory was proposed by Girolamo Fracastro, and by the late 1800s, viruses were identified. This solidified that many illnesses and diseases weren't spread by invisible ghosts or other spectacular supernatural beings. A quick example is vampires, who were also blamed for the spread of disease. They also had other theories like miasma, aka bad air, but in knowing now about those pesky, newfangled things called germs which were behind it, if it wasn't ghosts doing it, maybe ghosts weren't even real. Ironically, some scientific advancements would also kind of do the opposite. Energy was named also in the 1800s, and upon learning more about it, how to better conduct electricity and control it, and learning that we are made of energy, this would lead to new earthly and otherworldly speculations. Maybe this energy in us is what our conscience is made of and is what becomes a ghost. This belief was accepted pretty well by the general public of the 19th century, who were struggling with their faith and dealing with extreme loss. In the US, infant mortality rates were high, and families grieved the deaths of husbands, brothers, and sons off at the Civil War. People were left grief-stricken and longing to believe that there is some place we go in death and that maybe, just maybe, they could talk to their deceased once more. And so, new methods of spirit communication would arise during this time that also conveniently reflected this new electric world, beginning with two young girls from Hydesville, New York, known as the Fox Sisters, who would ask questions to ghosts or spirits, again, basically synonymous, and in response to these questions, the entities would produce audible knocks and rappings. This methodology conveniently mimicked the electric telegraph, a long-distance communication method which debuted just a few years prior and which produced a series of dots and dashes as well as an audible tap or beep. The similarity between this phenomenon and the advancing technologies of the time gave it an air of credibility to rationalists and skeptics of the ghost, considering it appeared to be just as physical and observable as the new emerging technologies themselves. A trend which would repeat itself. Similarly, spirit photography would come about with the invention of the camera, but it's worth noting that the Fox sisters would later admit to trickery with their phantom knocks, and spirit photography would also soon be debunked and usually resulted from double exposure of the plates used in the photography process, or other clever effects. But the point still stands that ghosts, and what we think of them, are usually contemporary. Still ancient in origin, but modern in the role that we place them in and how they might interact with us or how we might seek them and interact with them for ourselves. In the beginning, ghosts helped to explain the unexplainable. As we made new discoveries, the ghost would change alongside our changing view of the world. They never could remain gone for long, reflecting our seemingly never-ending desire to believe in the other, that there is more out there, that our loved ones are still here, and that we can even talk to them. There is so much more to be said here, but I have to save some of this for future episodes, you know? And my vocal cords could use a good break while I get some semblance of the next script in order. On that note, what topics do you want to hear about regarding the paranormal? How the ghost is depicted in art throughout time would be fun, or how about cautionary tales and how ghost stories were sometimes used to scare kids into behaving well? I could talk about famous ghosts and the clout chasing some historic locations do by touting, "Hey, this famous dead king haunts us." How do we feel about these topics? Let me know, and I greatly look forward to the release of episode 2. All resources used in this episode are linked below in the show notes. You can follow Spiritus on Instagram at @spiritus_podcast and email me at spirituspod@gmail.com. Don't forget to leave a rating, review, and subscribe wherever you are listening. That alone is the easiest way to support your favorite podcasts. If I've succeeded, this is now one of them. Until next time, my name is Ivy Boyd, and thank you for listening to Spiritus. Research, script writing, hosting, editing, and all other areas of podcast production are by me, Ivy Boyd. Music is from Pixabay. Any mistakes made are entirely my own.